Team Time.
Welcome to Team Time Table Talks. I'm your host, Debbie Waith, and in this series, I'm going to be speaking with practitioners and experts about working with teams. I'll be discussing what working at the team level means from a practical perspective and how it's affected by increased uncertainty and remote working. My aim in this series is to optimise how we work, think and feel in teams to be more human, hopeful and helpful in our organisations. We'll hear my guests share their real-life experience and expertise in relation to working with teams and get past the soundbites to dig out the learnings and micro-tips that you can try with your teams today. We'll share stories from our practice to help bring our learnings to life, whilst of course respecting our clients' confidentiality. In this episode, I'm going to be speaking with Gestalt practitioner Marianne Shidiak, who's an OD practitioner, coach, supervisor and Gestalt psychotherapist, passionate about relational Gestalt in organisational settings. We talk about why having an orientation or theory of change is important in any OD or change work. And Marianne talks us through what a Gestalt orientation means and the core concepts that inform the approach, including the cycle of experience. What really struck me was the level of focus and care on helping a team to understand their most pressing need. Such an important skill in a time when people feel under so much pressure and are struggling to prioritise. At the core of Marianne's work is an inquiry into the experience in the moment, using presence, awareness and dialogue. Marianne and I explore what we mean by dialogue, which has been quite a fashionable word in recent years, and why it's important for the more complex dilemmas in a team. What resonated for me was Marianne's description of dialogue as a third point of view that shaped between us. For dialogue, we need to enter expecting to be changed, not expecting others to change, but expecting ourselves. And later in the episode, Marianne talks us through what a Gestalt approach might look like, whilst reminding us that it's emergent and not a methodology that we just apply. Marianne really struck me as being pragmatic in her approach and recognising it's no longer realistic in how we work or team to have the time we might want to build trust. We're usually part of so many tribes and teams, and we need to think more about dialogic skills that allow us to relate with others quickly and to build relationships and be open to be changed by conversation. And this fits with a Gestalt approach that's responsive, relational and emergent. We also talked about the role of the facilitator in this work. And Marianne introduces us to another core concept in Gestalt, the use of self, where we tune in to how we, the facilitator, is feeling and offer our feelings or sensations as data for what's informing me and how this might help the group. Using the felt experience of others to explore something important in the group dynamic. And of course, this means that we as facilitators have to have a high level of self-awareness to recognise what's our things and what is part of the group, and the importance of supervision when we use ourselves as vehicles in this way. She also talked about the moments of knowing when to intervene or not. And in many ways, I think this is the work which often feels magical or hidden in facilitation, but so important that whether as facilitator or leader, that we hold the range to be both evocative and provocative. Again, as in many episodes, we touch on the importance of small C contracting with the team involved to have a sense of what this work is. And Marianne talked about slowing down and pausing and inquiring into what just happened. It can be a glance, it can be a shift in energy, but we know when something's happened, we don't normally stay with it. And it's important that in our contracting with the team that these things are brought to an awareness. Similarly, when we're talking about emergent work, what it takes to do the big C contracting, when it can sometimes be hard to for others who are not in the room to understand what the work is. Marianne shares what she's noticed in leaders over the last 15 months and how she's adapted her work with the impact of the pandemic and more remote working. And reflecting as much on what we've learned and might want to keep and what more might be coming rather than pangs for days gone by. So I hope you enjoy listening to this episode and getting to know Gestalt a little better. And I wonder if it might be helpful to hold some questions for your team or the team you're working with. How do you think change actually happens in your team or organisation? What is the joint question most important for your team to come together on? And how do you bring or encourage in others more of the perceived weirdness to bring new thinking and new provocation? Hi, Marianne, and welcome to Team Timetable Talks. It's wonderful to have you with us today, and I'm really looking forward to this conversation and to exploring more about your experience in teams. Maybe just to get us started, if I could invite you to share a little bit about yourself and the work that you do.
Thank you, Debbie. I'm really looking forward to our conversation. About me, well, I'd say I'm an OD practitioner, I'm a coach, I'm also a supervisor and a Gestalt psychotherapist. So I like to think that I navigate these worlds, you know, enjoying how they intersect and as well actually being clear how they're different. So the other thing about me that hopefully will unfold in our conversation is that I'm passionate about Gestalt and its application to organizational settings, and particularly what I call relational organizational Gestalt, so ROG.
Okay, so that gives us a nice sort of intersect then into what is Gestalt. So I have talked in an earlier episode about my orientation toward teamwork, and I talk about relational, systemic, and dialogic. And in my practice, there are certainly principles from Gestalt. But what does it mean to have a Gestalt orientation? And if I can be a little bit pokey, why is having an orientation at all important?
Gosh, I'm going to start with the pokey bits first, actually, because it feels really important to me, just as you said that, that I just can't imagine my practice without this kind of foundation ground that informs me. You know, it's like, how do I decide what my next intervention is? How do I decide on the direction that I might be guiding this team and through this work with? And I think I rely a lot on my Gestalt practice. So I'm going to try to give you a bit of a sense of Gestalt, which is quite a complex area in some ways. It has its roots in a humanistic movement. And although it's known also as a therapeutic approach, it's been applied to organizational settings since the 1950s. So whether it's in OD or in consulting, coaching, and of course, facilitation practices. If I were to give the headline, I'd say Gestalt is an approach that focuses on exploring the needs, the tension within a team, if we're talking about teams here, as a way of facilitating a movement toward change. So what I would do is it's an inquiry. It's an inquiry into the experience in the moment of the team. So, you know, already me saying that, you can see that it's not something that you can preempt. You know, it's really quite a relational and an emergent approach. I guess Gestalt, you know, has several aspects, but a fundamental view or concept in Gestalt is that human beings and teams self-regulate. So they self-organize. And the primary way or drive for their self-organizing is to satisfy the most urgent need. So it's a need satisfaction sort of process. So for instance, the most urgent need for a team might be to gain clarity, you know, around a new situation or a deadline for an action. And you can tell it's the inability to prioritize and agree, you know, a joint figure to that need will lead to an ineffective response to the situation. So the team might be busy with some internal debates, different agendas in the room, or just being distracted by, you know, the day-to-day actions that, but in that moment are unlikely to lead to a satisfying outcome. So they're not focused on what matters most at this point in time. And as a Gestalt practitioner, that is what I try to do with a team. I support the team to gain a sense of what is their most pressing need and act on it. And I do that by heightening their awareness of that need, either through the phenomenological inquiry, an inquiry into their experience, through dialogue, through experimentation. So in working with a team, you know, you'll often see Gestalt practitioner trying to heighten awareness of process and patterns, you know, to make what's implicit and happening in the moment, but bring it out and making it more and verbalizing and making it more explicit. So you hear Gestalt practitioners say, just stay with that awareness, because that awareness would lead to something different, to change.
I guess we're used to, in many ways, considering change at the sort of behavioral individual level. Mm-hmm. And so I think what's interesting is when we're locating it at the team level, mm-hmm. and the interplay, if you like, between what's happening, even when you say satisfy the most urgent need, mm-hmm. what goes through my mind is whose?
Yeah, exactly.
And how power plays in that, because often, yes. you know, the most powerful yes. needs are the needs that are regarded as more urgent. And so I guess I'm just curious, that there's this stated most urgent need, yeah. and then there's the felt most urgent need. And how do yeah. you yeah. kind of recognize and work in that space? Yeah.
It's a lovely, lovely question, because it just puts a finger on it, about the complexity of working in teams. Because in a way, what you're saying, you know, that there's the experience of individuals that will be different. And then in order to have a good outcome, all these experiences of individuals need to come together and form a joint experience of a team. And so if you imagine, and I know we haven't got pictures here, so I'll try to describe it. What a lot of people know about Gestalt is what they call their cycle of experience. So it's the sense that we each have a cycle, a self-regulation cycle of how we operate and our experience of the world. And so you imagine in a team, every person has their own cycle. And what we're trying to do is gather through compromise, through dialogue, for the whole team to have one cycle, one awareness, one figure around which they all mobilize.
Would you be able to take us round the cycle of experience so we can visualize in our minds?
Yes. Okay. So let me do it first as a cycle for an individual. Okay, as an example first. Okay. So the cycle tracks how as human beings we experience and respond to the external world or need in our field. By first we note it, we're noting it. There's a sensation. For example, I notice that I'm hungry. Okay, I notice a sensation, which is a grumbling in my stomach. Then I try to make meaning of it. Ah, I recognize it. This is awareness that this is hunger. Then I prepare my response to this. I mobilize, I go towards the fridge, I take action, you know, I take an apple out of the fridge, I bite into it, something changes in me, my hunger abates, and then I go towards withdrawal, closure. And then a new figure, a new cycle starts. So that's a small description. And in groups, you know, working with groups or team, Gestalt says that to maintain a healthy group process and experience, it flows from an agreed upon awareness. So all these different needs in the room of individuals, when you work in a group, and what the Gestalt practitioner does is tries to bring all these needs to join one figure. Yeah. In other words, individual within the group must agree on a common figure of interest around which energy can be mobilized and action taken to reach a satisfying resolution. You know, in some ways you say, well, it's a truism. You know, of course, we all know about goal setting, you know, in organizations. But a joint figure can't be determined by a few. You know, you talked about power. It can't just be saying, you know, yes, the boss says we're going to do that. And then everyone's there. I'm not quite sure. It doesn't agree with my department. I'm just going to pay lip service to it. So in Gestalt, we try to unearth all of this. And so rather than a joint figure imposed, you know, in order, it says, our theory or our approach says, in order to find a satisfying and sustainable outcome, you know, it has to emerge from dialogue in which all those concerns can have a voice. Mm. So we're really talking about a common group figure, which might need for individuals to compromise or just to decide to prioritize different needs to respond to the overall need of the group. So it's quite complex.
Yes, and I think it's complex at an individual level.
Yes.
And how we notice, sense make, experiment, and then learn through that. And then you bring in the sort of added complexity of the dynamics across all the individuals toward this common. Mm-hmm. But I think the thing that helps me in the understanding is, because you said, you know, that this the most senior person can't just come in and make the decisions. Well, of course, that's exactly what can and does happen. But the bit that I think you're clarifying is to say, if we're looking for a satisfying and sustainable outcome, and I think in many ways that's the distinguishing factor is, when we're working in teams and we're trying to understand what might be the most impactful outcome, it's rarely in complex terms through one person's sort of choice and decision. And so that for me is a big sort of like, but the question I've got is, how do you in this work come to that common group figure? By which I think you mean we agree what we're going to focus on. And I ask this because I'm in some conversations just now that are pretty typical of, you know, those early conversations where the most senior person in an organization has a view and a hypothesis as to what needs to be done. And he has a view as to what the dilemma is. Mm. And of course, you know, I think in our sort of orientations, we'd say, well, you know, that's one piece of information and data, but actually that's not the same thing as a common group figure.
Yeah,
and so I guess I'm just curious, in your work, how do you get to the common group figure? Because that seems quite an important part of any process.
It is. I think it is. And I want to also say, you know, from a very pragmatic view, not every organizational decision can be taken through that sort of dialogue with a common view. Sometimes there are very simple decisions that are just taken above, and that's, you know, that's how it is. Mm. So there's an understanding of where are, you use the word dilemmas. Where are the dilemmas? Where are the more complex conversations that need to happen? Where are the most complex decisions which will require the investment in time and dialogue to ensure a common figure? And therefore, a better flow, if you like, of experience around that cycle.
Mm.
And, you know, as I said, the way to do it is really to slow things down. I mean, there's several aspects here to take into account. First, the inquiry. So what I'd be doing as a practitioner is always tracking where is the group cycle and where can I recognize the individual cycles are, where the members of a group are in terms of their different stages on the cycle of experience. So at any given moment in time, some group members may be mobilized, ready to move an action, saying, oh, we know what we need to do. You know, we need to just, you know, go for this marketing sort of approach. Whilst others, usually those perhaps that haven't sort of aren't in agreement or don't feel they can agree, haven't yet a clear figure of what really is that thing that we most need to organize in. So as a coach, I'd be highlighting, I'd be asking people to voice, to note. I might even use the cycle of experience as a framework, as a diagnostic, and ask people, you know, we can do this on Zoom these days, of course, but, you know, if we're in the room, you know, I'd draw it up and say, okay, we're talking about this, you know, and where are you now? Are you still unclear that we've looked at it, we've sense-made enough? Are you clear what is the figure of the action needs to be? Are you there mobilizing, ready for action? You know, where are you? And let's sort of make sure if there's a large discrepancy, what's the dialogue that needs to happen in the group in order to make this figure crisper. So I use the cycle of experience, you know, as a diagnostic tool in those instances. And it positions individuals and it just gives that common view.
And what's your experience in doing this work, particularly if there are clear divergences in the individuals in where they are on the cycle of experience, perhaps even to the point where, you know, if you're starting with a sensation of, do I recognize, where people don't recognize and have very different experiences. I guess I'm wondering in my mind, is the intention to try get everybody to a similar experience, or how do we honor that diversity of experience? And what does that mean and do if we do honor that difference?
I think what you, for me, when you pose that question, what you're talking about is the power of dialogue. Because, of course, we won't all have the same experience. There is diversity in the room. And I guess dialogue is a stance towards others, you know, as well as a concert, you know, a sharing of yourself, which enables something new, you know, and unexpected to come up. So, you know, I'd say, you know, how are we going to dialogue whilst expecting to be changed? You know, how can it not just be my need or your need or my experience or your experience, but how can we then, through dialogue, you know, formulate a third position, something new, which includes compromise, of course. I think this aspect of dialogue is important, yeah.
Can we kind of just go back a step? I think dialogue as a term is out there in sort of the practitioner community, but I'm not entirely sure it translates into every organization that we work with. Now, my understanding when we break down the word is that it's the meaning created through, you know, those people involved. And so it's sort of, I find a very helpful distinction between monologues versus debates versus advocacy, where we're kind of more really just speaking on behalf of oneself, whereas dialogue for me is actually the creation of what happens between us, as you say, that third position. I just think we need to sort of be conscious of the terminology that we use, and I think in some ways does it create a layer that just feels a little bit mysterious? What do you mean?
Well, at one level, at a very simple level, I feel a team is always in dialogue, even in the absence of conversation. You know, dialogue is going on, isn't it? So dialogue isn't just about what's being said, but also about maybe the non-verbal messages that are conveyed or received, you know. And how, for me, how to acknowledge and work with the different flavors of dialogue that go on in a team, you know, when I'm coaching them. So it's not just about you know, it could be in this way, how can we have some of the less obvious, it's not about reporting, it's not a monologue, absolutely. It's something where I speak, wait for your response and expect to be changed in that conversation. If, you know, if I were to put it very simply, that's what I would say. Mm. And sometimes, you know, Debbie, I think people that hear the word dialogue go to, of course, the work of David Bohm, William Isaacs and others that, you know, some of your listeners might know. And they are amazing and inspiring concepts. But dialogue isn't just about getting to know each other in the group, although that's important to build trust. So in Gestalt, often we talk about dialogue and use the work of Martin Buber, you know, of how to have some I-thou moments, which is very powerful. I think the skills of dialogue, meaning enabling that connection and that ability to be changed through conversation, I think it's crucial for teams, exactly because I think there isn't time these days to get to know each person and build trust to such a level that then you, though the work is possible. Mm. So we often talk about, you know, the notion of very tightly knit teams. And I think in my early days, we used to call, we need to have a high performing team, which means, you know, very tightly knit where everyone knows and trusts each other to a, you know, nth degree. But, there's less and less time available to do that. And I recall, you know, very early on in my career, I was working with a supply chain team and taking them through, you know, at the time, the methodology of high-performance team process. And I think someone in the team very rightly pointed out to me that he belonged to so many teams, he couldn't possibly do this for every one of them. Mm. And so, you know, we're wired to think that, you know, who's part of my tribe, who's part of my team, and then we get really close and we get to know each other. But of course, we're part of so many different tribes and teams. Mm. And so when working to team, we must think dialogue skills, you know, what are the skills that I can have to be able to quickly relate to someone else, to understand their positions, to build relationship rapidly, to be changed through the conversation. And that's what I mean by dialogue.
So just to help people understand, when you make reference to Martin Buber, I, thou, and of course the sort of the other is I, it, and dialogic skills. Yes. What do you mean when you say I, thou, and yes, what that would mean in terms of skills in relation to dialogue?
Okay. So, you know, I'm really aware we're sort of skimming the surface here, but I'll give you an answer. I think for those who haven't read anything by Martin Buber, I'd recommend it first. You know, I think Martin Buber wrote on dialogue, and he says we relate to each other. You know, the I, thou for him is how to relate as a subject, not an object. And he called this type of relating I, thou. So engaging with the other person in a dialogue of equals, you know, and it, which involves, you know, seeing the whole of the other person. And these are amazing and inspirational words. Yeah. And Buber distinguishes between this type, as you said, of relating and what he calls the I, it, which is relating where we're just perceiving certain aspect in another person. I'll give you an example. You know, we can, you know, we do this all the time in organizations because we have to. You know, we might go and buy a train ticket in the good old days before the pandemic, of course. And, you know, you might not necessarily really look at the person who you're buying the ticket from. And often we do so much of that in teams. We're just talking, but we're not really seeing the response. We're not noticing. So, you know, informing or bringing some of these dialogue skills of how can you notice, how can you see, how can you be present in yourself enough to notice what's happening in the other person, be inclusive. That means have a sense of what it must be like to be them, in a bit, and just get a sense of what's going on for them and for you as you engage in that dialogue. Okay, we can't always do that in teams, you know, and that's something that I make very, you know, explicit when I talk about dialogue, that, you know, sometimes we and I call this the difference, the I thou I it, I call it the difference between being intimate versus strategic. And sometimes in teams we need to do the, you know, the intimate conversation, sometimes the strategic. But how for the process of the team to be slow enough to know where are they? Are they being strategic? Are they being intimate? Is there, you know, is there a need to have a different type of conversation? I often find, or I sometimes find that they're talking about something or are trying to debate a content point in a team and or strategy, and it just goes round and round and round. There's a stuckness there. And often for me, is the stuckness is that there isn't enough of the intimate conversation going on. Do I acknowledge, do I see, or do I, you know, maybe someone feels unheard, not heard, so they keep going back to their point over and over again. So teaching, bringing awareness to of a team of these skills of dialogue feel really important. Just to complete the picture actually for you, Debbie, if that's okay, you know, I talked about intimate strategic. There's another also dimension of dialogue that often gets missed in teams is it a unifying or a fragmenting dialogue? You know, are we just listening to voices, or is there a need to find a commonality, a coming together around a single voice? So I try to bring these two continuums into my coaching work, and I guess heighten the awareness of the team of where they are and how they can be working with that.
I have to admit that there's part of me in the work that I do, and I often sort of orient to a triangle where I'm noticing the quality of the relationships and well-being. Yes. And then to another one is the sort of response and complexity, you know, the quality of thinking and the ability to collectively think. And the third coroner is performance. But within that is clarity of intention, clarity of purpose, agreed standards and values.
Yes,
and lovely. I think the thing that I'm wondering is where we have intimate and strategic, in some ways, I would need both for a strategic, you know, for a strategic conversation, the intimacy of those relationships to feel safe enough to bring news of difference, to, you know, check the assumptions, which is, again, one of the areas that often seems sort of ignored, is that we don't question the assumptions. And so I wonder whether my line, which I hadn't realized I had, was intimacy, but it's the operational, tactical, transactional, which actually perhaps doesn't need quite as much intimacy. But for me, the strategic does need the intimacy.
Yes. I'd agree with you, actually, you know, not seeing these as polarities. You know, it's not an either or, it's a dialectic, you know. And the more conversations around complex issues we're having, the more we need to sort of make sure that we're having, you know, a good mixture of both, you know, and sort of noticing how the conversation is flowing. And as a coach, that's what you're spending a lot of time noticing and observing. I mean, as I don't know about you, and I'm sure it's not just common to Gestalt practitioners, but we have, you know, at the heart of my practice is a notion of the use of self. You know, I spend a lot of, you know, my energy saying, you know, what's informing me? What's my feelings in this moment? What are my sensations? As well as my cognitive knowing, so what am I thinking? I'm also checking my body all the time, checking my feelings. And I think this informs my interventions with my teams. So I think all of that is, you know, when I say you inquire and you notice, but you have to sort of be in a place where you can notice.
I was just going to say, I think that it's also become far more apparent, you know, the level of self-awareness of each of those team members to recognize within themselves. And you know, I think, do we have the ability to voice what we feel or have sensed? That's to me a different question, but starting just with the noticing and the leader, you know, feeling able to bring in some of that, and it not just being, for example, our role that does that, which of course, when we leave the room, when the work ends, for me, one of the successful measures of our work is that level of noticing, voicing, you know, acknowledging and working with the others' felt senses is part of how we know that actually that's now a sustained practice.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. You know, it's certainly not about us coming just and practicing in that way without modeling a way of being. You know, hopefully you're also modeling and inviting team members to sort of, you know, sweat in the slowing down, you know. I think this is very provocative sometimes approach in Gestalt to say, it's just hold on a second, let's pause here. What's just gone on? What have you noticed? You know, something happened really quickly here, or there was no eye contact, or there was some sort of, and I guess it's about slowing that and inviting people and maybe contracting for that. And I do that a lot when I, you know, come with teams. I say, you know, this is how I'm going to work, and I'm going to ask you to pause and check what's going on, and make this, almost normalize this at the beginning of the engagement. Of course, we meet teams where they are. Some teams will have more ability to do that than others, but that's part of the work, I think.
I spoke on the first episode a lot about setting up well, and I think one of those aspects was, you know, not only us being clear on how we work, because it's informed with our beliefs of how change happens, but also what that means in terms of the commitment by the team in the process. And the flags, of course, that these kind of processes, in my opinion, can't be foisted on a team, can't be used, for example, because, you know, people are unhappy with one member of the team. That's not what these are there to serve. And I think for me, that small C contracting is so important in what enables the potential of what can happen in that work. And I agree with you. I think being clear up front without frightening anyone, but just sort of saying we part of this will be pausing, part of this will be slowing down, part of this will be just acknowledging that was a moment that mattered. And it was a glance, but it mattered. It made a difference to what next was possible.
Yes, I agree. I so agree. And I think sometimes, and I speak about, you know, myself as well, and I think I've probably gotten better through practice and experience, but, you know, I think it's the position of being brave, whether you're an external coach or whether you're a team leader or an HR practitioner. It's about how to really carry in yourself the way you can be provocative in those ways, in that moment. In Gestalt, let's bring to mind Edwin Nevis, one of the early writers on Gestalt theory and organization, distinguishes, you know, the balance between evocative and provocative in how you work. And I think that feels so important to hold that range. So being evocative is modeling, is eliciting, you know, and being provocative is being a bit more challenging. Mm. So the question for a leader or a coach is, what's the situation needing from me at the moment? Mm. And I still find that beautiful. And I think it's a practice that we can all keep asking ourselves, you know, have I been provocative enough?
Well, and I've had a conversation with fellow practitioners in other episodes where we've examined the varying sort of roles that facilitators play. And of course, most people, I think, sort of see it as the design and the frame and, you know, you come in and you guide us on the day.
Yeah.
And actually, I think that the nuances are what makes it the work. Yes. And those moments of knowing when to intervene or not, to yes. know actually, as you say, am I holding the possibility to evoke or provoke? Mm. What is it? And one of the things that I've learned in the work is also just such importance of your own level of self-awareness,
yes.
to know what's you in this. Because of course, you know, if I come from my systemic perspective, I'm not really out, I'm not separate. I am
no.
part of. And yes. so recognizing there'll be some of my stuff, you know, the interweave. And it's a constant sort of checking of oneself, yeah. whilst also, yeah. I think we're the vehicle through which teams often experience themselves,
yes.
you know, as a lightning rod nearly. And so there's something that says also, you know, that's so insightful, but don't get lost in it because it's not actually about you. and so I'm getting airs of that as well in terms yes. of just what this means for what the role is in this work.
Yes. Yes. I think that is absolutely true. And, you know, when you use yourself, you know, in that way as an instrument, what you're saying is that I'm trusting that whatever becomes noticeable to me or whatever really strikes me has got as much to do with me as it has to do with the team in front of me. So it's talking to your point, as you know, we're a bit mirror, we're mirrors there. We're what we're experiencing is relevant. And that's why offering it back in whatever way we can, and which is what we do often in our provocation, isn't it? Is you know, even if you say something as simple as, well, I'm really noticing that the energy is very heavy at the moment after you said X. You know, what am I doing? I'm noticing something that's happened in me and I'm offering it there, knowing in that, you know, of course, if I don't know myself, I might think, oh my God, it's just me, I'm anxious. But actually, the more you know yourself and the more you've worked on yourself, then the more obvious it is that very often, not always, very often it's to do with the work and the team that you're working with.
Mm.
That's why I get onto my other really important aspect, you know, for a coach for me is, do they have supervision?
Well, that's exactly what I was thinking.
Really? Oh, good. We're on the same page here.
Well, I mean, I guess my slight bugbear, and it's sort of an area that I try to support just as a community, is mm-hmm. that I think many of us do supervision as coaches, meaning one-to-one work. I don't right. think it's as common practice to do supervision for teamwork. And in my experience, teamwork has, you know, many layers of complexity more that means it's essential. And I'm not sort of saying, oh, so you know, this is the gap that needs to be closed, you know, and lots of companies chase that. But just as a practitioner from an ethical point of view, I think it's really important that we have in the background that level of challenge and support
yes.
As we sense make what's happening there.
I agree. I totally agree with you. I mean, as a you know, as a Gestalt practitioners, you know, organization, and I train other Gestaltists, whatever their field of work is, whether it's one-to-one or teams, or indeed even OD work, more general OD work, I think supervision is key. Supervision is key. You know, it's you're using yourself as a vehicle to understand. And so you know, having that sense checking mechanism and support is crucial.
I'm going to go out on a limb here, Marianne, and see if you agree or not, but it would really fill my heart if more clients were to inquire and expect us, firstly, to have an orientation and to be really clear on what informs how we work and how we believe theory of change happens. And secondly, to expect and require that we are constantly in sort of the process of because of the nature of the role, our own learning and self-awareness through something like supervision. And for me, if those two things could become more common part of the initial conversations, I think that takes a step up for everybody, you know, in terms of the likely quality of work that you'll get, but also for us to have to expect that we should be talking about this, and that there should be expectations that we continue our professional development. But what's your thoughts?
Well, your listeners can't see me nodding furiously and putting my thumbs up because, you know, my view is why wouldn't we? Why wouldn't we? And I think as a discipline, if we could call it that, you know, of team coaches, I think this is probably an imperative next step. You know, we see these processes and this rigor being already applied in the one-to-one coaching arena. You know, most coaches are accredited in any way, are required to have supervision. They've got, you know, certain things that they need to abide by. And I think it's just probably, in my personal view, a sense of maybe the immaturity still of the team coaching profession, and even the OD profession to some extent, that this still hasn't happened. So my hope, you know, for the future is that there will be more of that. Mm. Not in a dogmatic way, but I think to encourage leaders and practitioners to answer that very crucial question, how do I think change actually happens? Mm. And I, as a trainer, some sort of OD and coaches, you know, this is one of the key questions that I ask. And to be fair, most people have it, but I'm not sure that a lot of practitioners have it made explicit enough to support their work as much as it could. So whether it's gestalt or else, and something else, of course.
And, you know, for me, the drive isn't to be, you know, a purist academic or you know, it to be any particular theoretical basis, but it's because I just remember when I was in the business world and we were receiving PowerPoints, you know, pretty regularly from head office that what we needed to do that were intended to make sites safer, which of course had such importance and good intention. But for me, it kind of lacked that, is this actually what's going to change behaviours? Yeah. And it kind of propelled my own journey into trying to understand what underpinned human behavioural change. Yeah. And I think we, you know, raising that awareness at a team level of, you know, I feel the frustration, but what's your, you know, head of team presumption and assumptions about both what's happening here and how you think it will change? And it brings, I think, more transparency to their own thinking and to the team's own thinking. So it's not just about serving our theoretical interests. It's about the team gaining a greater awareness of how things happen in their own team and therefore within their own organization.
Yeah. And I think it also allows the sense checking. It's not just about how do I intervene, but once I've intervened, you know, and I've had that sort of outcome, you know, how do I make sense of that? You know, what's my next point of call? And I guess, and you know, that's why it's not really about the framework, but it's how to use it. You know, if you've got a framework that speaks to you as a practitioner, if you've got an approach that speaks to you, I think just sort of stay with it, you know, be loyal to it in some ways and explore the depth of it rather than just present one model and that's it.
Mm. Can you give us a sense just what a process with you in terms of a Gestalt orientation looks like? What is it that teams would expect to do with you? And you know, again, one of my aims with this series is trying to lift the lid a little bit on what I think is often quite hidden work, because it's dealing with teams and sensitivities we don't really get to see in. And I'm trying to share as many processes as possible so that people get a sense of what can I expect? What should I expect? What could I ask for? And I just wonder, are you able to share just, you know, a broad shape of what a process is for you?
Yes, I can. And I think when I, when you asking the question, what was going on for me was saying, it's never a fixed process. You know, otherwise, you know, we'd be applying methodology rather than being responsive. And I'm hopefully I'm giving you that sense of how much Gestalt is a responsive, you know, and we respond to what's going on in the moment. But of course, there are some broad principles that guide my work. And for me, any organizational development work that I'm engaged in. Of course, there's an entry phase, the contracting phase. And then for me, I have to do, I do a co-diagnosis, you know, and I'll talk more, maybe I'll say more about that. But if I expanded on it, so what are the things I pay attention to when I start? And I'd say I think I pay attention what my point of entry into a team is. You know, who's commissioned the work? Am I known to them? Have I been coaching someone there? Have I been referred to this organization through another person? And if so, how was that process? All these entry points for me will impact the work. It's part of the ground, you know, of the work. If I've been coaching team leader, for example, I have to ask myself, how will this shape the working alliance I have with other team members? And then how best to first engage with them? Do I do one-to-one meetings, or do I meet them as a group straight away? Do I do some subgroups? And that depends on how the team is formed. And of course, who else do I need to meet that might help me sense into the team, understand the patterns, the influences, their demand, etc. So, you know, it really, it depends. And I guess what I'm looking here is what is creating a good enough containment for the work. And I think there's always a balance between having one-to-one meetings at the start of an engagement with all the team members. And if I were, you know, being very honest here, sometimes I wonder whether, how much is that supporting the coach versus supporting the team? Of course, it's important to have good working alliances with each team member, but that's a judgment call. If, for example, I know that the issue is already an issue of conflict in the team, so the energy, you know, the emotions are high, then I think containment requires closer working alliances. So then I probably will make an effort to inquire, you know, to meet the team members initially, one-to-one. And it's not a data gathering, you know, relationship, but it's more a relationship building. So it's not data gathering per se. I'm really asking them what's their understanding and experience of being in the team. But if I don't do that in a one-to-one, that's probably what I would do in my first meeting with them as a whole. One, I try to give them a flavor of how I work, what to expect, you know, a bit of what we were talking about before, a bit of contracting, laying it out there. But I'm also in the first meeting, I'm trying to see whether there is, you know, going back to the joint figure, is there a joint figure of what this coaching needs to be? Do they have a same view of what is needed? Can they share it? Can they listen to each other? So what I'm doing in this first meeting is also doing a lot of observing and echoing back of what I see. It gives me an insight into them as a team and the patterns or dynamics I have. And what I do is I try to be very transparent in my reflections back. What I notice, I invite them to add their own perceptions, disagree with me, their noticings. And what I'm aiming for here is that word that I said initially, that co-diagnosing. I think it's there in most any approach that is relational, I would say, where the team coach doesn't set themselves up as an expert, but I'm a guide alongside a journey that they will take and that I will kind of contain them in different ways. So I really feel it's important at that initial stage for the team not to feel done to. And I have turned down engagements, actually, where I've just felt that I've been brought because someone up there wanted to do this work. And actually, there was no, this lovely English expression, there was no skin in the game for the team. And I don't think that really leads to good team coaching. So part of what I'm doing is saying, what's of interest? And it might not be, you know, the most needed thing that I see. You know, I might see something different, but I think, where's the energy in the room? And I try to work with that. So, so once I have a sense of that, and I sometimes use some frameworks, I use maybe the framework of a team presence or something like that. And then once we have a sense of key areas of work, I can, you know, agree depending on availability and how the organization works, you know, how often we meet, whether they're specific coaching sessions, whether they could be a mixture of that plus tagging on, you know, me looking at their normal team sessions and then doing an intervention at the end of that. So again, the big answer of it depends.
And it ties back to your earlier remark that it's an emergent process rather than a planned process. I think the thing that I suspect people may be sitting with is, how on earth do I contract for that and get budget for something that, I think both points are valid. One is, you know, we've got budget, we've got time to have to understand how, you know, what will I get from it? Yes. And yet we also have to acknowledge and respect that we can't promise you what will come from it, but what we can offer is a light structure as to how these things unfold. And yes. Then for me, I think one of the things that I turn to is how you'll know the differences that might be made in the quality of that team.
Yes,
but it does require, I think, quite a bit of trust in that. So I'm curious how you have those conversations when people want to know, often in the contract, like the big C contracting stuff.
Yes.
What am I going to get from this? Tell me how often, what you'll bring, etc.
Yes. You know, Debbie, I do something a lot of my colleagues actually that aren't, you know, don't work in the same way probably say, oh, why'd you do that? Why don't you go for a longer, you know, why don't you just tell them it's going to be a longer piece of work and then you don't need to. But I really believe that part of my approach is about an iterative contracting. I use really this word in iteration. So I'll say, you know, let's give us this amount of time, whether paid time or whatever it is contract. And let's review, you know, this is an initial focus but this might change because of course things do change. And then, so it does require, you know, a close, you know, a greater trust, but hopefully this is what I spend also a bit of time with whoever holds the work. And when the people commissioning the work are too far from the work, then I try to, you know, find another workaround because that can become a problem.
I think that's really insightful, though. It's an iterative approach. It's not trying to convince or sell, but actually, you know, through that more iterative approach, your team become the advocates for it rather than you. And that shifts where the contracting actually sits then.
Yes. you know, it should be a relationship. I know we keep saying that, and of course everyone says that this is a relationship that we enter to, but you know, our behaviors sort of demonstrate that. You know, and I think we shouldn't be salespeople. You know, when you say we shouldn't be pushing the work, I think the work needs to be a combination of also the team wanting it and being engaged.
And somewhat linked back to, you know, our understanding of ourselves as practitioners, you know, we shouldn't be afraid to walk away from the work when we know this isn't either the right intervention or the expectations are just too mismatched. Yes. And I think, you know, people typically learn that through experience. Yes. But again, that's part of the trying to lift the lid on this, is to recognize and pay, you know, quality attention to if it doesn't feel right. Yes. Or you're getting consistently stuck. Yes. That's actually useful in terms of what will likely unfold in the continuing process.
I totally agree. And I have walked away from engagement. You know, primarily, I mean, I think what comes to mind is a situation, you know, where they're trying to, I was coaching a multidisciplinary team and there just wasn't enough engagement, and there was a lot of fear, and there was quite a disruptive element in that organization that was about to leave, you know. So she was serving already her notice for 3 months going, and the disruption that she was creating was just not helpful. You know, I personally turned and I said, listen, you know, how about starting this work after she leaves? You know, and I guess give more containment for the work to happen.
And it's also people. I think there's something about respecting both the team and the work that says actually it's just not the right time. You will get to the work, but let this team settle. Yes. and have the capacity, quite honestly, to do the work. Yes. And whilst, you know, there are other things taking the attention and the energy and the emotional energy, there just isn't the space. No, but I guess it's similar in that vein. It's been a tough old year for many teams and for many of us as individuals. I'm curious what's been your experience of the last, you know, more than a year now, and how it's shown up in your work, perhaps how you've had to adapt your work.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's certainly been quite a year. And I don't think anyone would have predicted this level of disruption for us all. I think what I have seen certainly is more unsettled leaders and teams, individuals who are really struggling with very unique challenges that they've never faced before. Mm. You know, for example, you know, I had someone talking about how to disinfect a whole building on a regular basis. So, how to continue to provide, you know, their quality service with people operating, you know, really remotely, which was quite, so really difficult decisions. And of course, you know, in some industries, you know, a question whether the business will even survive. So it's been tough from that point of view. I think the social isolation has also, especially within team, I think upped the level on the sense of disconnection. You know, I think work, certainly, you know, teamwork provides always a sense of a kind of a professional family. I think we often underestimate that. And now a lot of people still are experiencing the demands of work without the social rewards, you know, the casual chats, the water cooler chats, and going down the pub, sharing snippets of holiday. And I think, to be fair, organizations have tried to do that, but it's not the same. So I think a lot of my work has gone online, and that has been also challenging in different ways, you know.
I certainly, my own experience has been that, in the conversation I had with Catherine Green, who's an HR director, one of her challenges to our industry is to, I guess, learn from this period in terms of being flexible in how, more flexible in how we do the work, and that the days of the presumption of multi-day offsites has left us now. And I rise to the challenge to really take that seriously, because I think there is much that we can do in the virtual world. And I also reserve the space to say the quality of connection in the live interaction and the what happens between us at a physiological and emotional level when we're in the room together is also really important when we're working with teams. So I do think it's an and rather than, you know, an either or. And for me, it's that, can we feel each other's experience on the screen in the way that we could in the room? I haven't really managed to replicate that to the quality that you would hope for in the room. And that's the bit, quite frankly, I'm really looking forward to getting back into. But what's been your experience of that?
Yeah, I'd agree with the challenge, actually. And in fact, I'm excited by that challenge, because I think I really think that working virtually has a lot to offer. But like you, I would go with a hybrid approach. Mm-hmm. And I think we're still learning a lot about working online. And my fantasy is that even perhaps our brains are rewiring and adapting more to this work, you know, whether as practitioners or you know, individual members of team. So I like the hybrid approach, because I think it gives, a good mix of the flexibility of the virtual versus, you know, the need of people to see and feel each other in a different way. So if I were to sort of say what's the primary difference about working virtually, where I've struggled actually more, is how the difficulty rather than how the greater difficulty to sustain engagement, and presence. So because online, as we know, we miss so much of nonverbal cues. We all see each other in small pictures on the screen. It's more difficult to pick up or notice emotion or feeling state. In some ways, our mirror neurons are firing less, you know. We experience less empathy. Not because we're not empathetic, just because we haven't got a lot of data to resonate with. So I find that it's often safer for team members to just stick to task, to cognition, and sometimes to check out emotionally or even completely at times, you know. I mean, less so as we contract around behavior online, but certainly that disengagement has been probably the biggest issue. Go on.
I was just going to say, I think one of the early indicators for me was the use of the camera. And, you know, I think we've learned through the last, you know, however many months it's been, to contract about cameras, you know, on or off, and to get more skilled actually in recognizing when is it helpful to have them off, because actually we need to move, we need to not always feel like we're being viewed all the time. But equally, in some works, in some qualities of conversations, we need to see each other. And I think in the earlier times, there was moments where it felt like the camera was being weaponized. You know, this was how I could signal something to the other without having to say it. And so I think we're learning new signals and signs and learning to navigate, you know, well, what's the agreement on those? But there's still a chunk of data that we don't get by not actually feeling, you know, how the others are.
But that's where I think for me being braver and actually saying, oh, you've just turned your video, your camera off. I notice I'm wondering whether you're doing something else. And I could do that, you know, with the team leader, I imagine you could do that. Just not saying you are doing something else or shaming the other person, but actually just owning that that's my projection. And when I have that projection, then that's going to impact how I am in the team and my behavior.
Yeah.
And then what I end up focusing on.
You do sort of raise for me, though, So I think within a team situation, that's more possible. In a group situation where we don't necessarily have that same level of psychological safety, I think even inquiring can feel an attack or a shaming. Yeah. And so it's much harder to judge what's the unintended impact, not just on that individual, but on the others that might think, oh dear, I'm going to be called out on that if I don't show up in a certain way. And I think that's why it's so important that we understand, is it a team? Is it a group? What's the contract between us? What are we committed to do? And recognize how the tools serve us or not. Because otherwise it's hard to make those judgments.
Yeah. There's some organizations where everyone is just, there's no videos at all except the person that's talking. And I think that's, you know, daunting. That's, you know, doesn't make for a lot of interaction or support for the person, of course, presenting or trying to convey a point.
But I've seen it both ways, though, where virtual has seemed to democratize because everybody can access. Yes, but then I've seen, you know, I've heard some organizations where only the most senior are to have their cameras on and everybody else is to have their cameras off.
Exactly.
And again, you sort of go, wow, you know, we weren't, I think, ever planning that these would become tools of oppression or suppression. But interesting. And I do think it changes our role as facilitators that, again, it goes back to that, okay, well, you know, not only do we start with where our client is, but we also try to bring practice that we've seen has, you know, benefits the quality of whatever the discussion is. So what have we learned? And I think there's more to go in terms of the learnings and the bravery and the letting go of the old assumptions as to what we think is good work.
I agree. And also embracing actually sometimes what the technology can bring us, can give us.
Absolutely.
You know, I have been surprised by and not in groups necessarily, not in large groups certainly, but maybe in teams, you know, how much experimentation can happen using some of these online kind of tools. So I think for those leaders or coaches that are used to primarily being, you know, in the room and having the flexibility of experimenting in the room, you know, maybe we need to sort of also spend a bit of time, you know, seeing how to take an experiment on Zoom, you know, through whiteboard. You know, it's been amazing, you know, just creating that shared experience, which made given a whole different dimension.
I certainly think it's a helpful challenge to be asked what's the sort of appropriate delivery form for whatever it is that we're suggesting, and that we should have to be clear on if we are saying it's virtual or we are saying it's hybrid or we're saying it's in person, why? And I think that's a fair question that you know, I would invite HR professionals, OD professionals and our clients to keep asking, particularly as we sort of walk through this next year or more, where we're trying to figure out how organizations, you know, the choices they're going to make and the impact that will have on teams.
Yeah, I agree. And the impact on the investment, you know, that would be primarily, I mean, there's huge, much more financial investment, you know, investment of time when you do it in person. So they are really good questions for us as practitioners and for organizations and leaders.
So can I invite you to share what I'm calling a micro practice? I'm asking all my guests to share a micro practice with our listeners that they could take and practice with their own teams today. Just sort of building on your own experience.
Yeah, well, I sort of thought about that, and then Debbie, I think you've released your first episode, and I realized that my micro practice was similar to your first guest. So I decided to give an even easier one. So I would say I would encourage people to use silence. Let the silence, I guess, speak. After you set a question, share a thought, make an intervention, whether you're a leader or a coach. Let the silence be. Think of it as time to let the team, I guess, catch up with where you are. Don't feel rushed to fill the space. And at some level, this might seem incredibly simple, but can be hugely impactful. And it usually, what it does, it just slows down the process. And my experience is that it opens up a much deeper, much more meaningful conversation.
Mm.
Don't just take the first response. Just sort of give yourself more. It's almost like inviting more spaciousness into the team.
I love that. And I have to say, in the sort of 12 years since I did my master's, where we would practice silence, and you know, I think there's just something about noticing your own relationship with hearing speaking, and whether we can tolerate it when we're with others. And I agree, I think it sort of goes back to Martin Buber's I it, I thou, of being able to both experience ourselves but also others. And I think they're one of the conduits is through silence.
Yes, I agree. I agree.
And thank you.
I guess the challenge is a lot of self-support. So my invitation to your listeners is to just self-support, breathe out, and just be with silence for a bit.
So silence and breathe.
Yes, silence and breathe. That's the micro skill. Yes, that's the tip.
What is it, as you look ahead, that you are hopeful for, Marianne?
You know, of course, with the end of the pandemic, for all of us to be more choiceful, you know, tapping back onto what we were just talking about, choiceful about how and why we work with teams in the way we do, whether it's through technology or not. And also, I'm hopeful for a return somewhat to the room and to more embodied work, you know, working with teams through embodiment and movement, which is much more difficult virtually. If I look much further out, I have this fantasy that there's lots of technology inventions and inventors busy polishing new ways of interacting virtually that will soon become the norm. And I'm hopeful for that. Some sort of touchable holograms. You know, you probably can tell I'm a bit of a closet science fiction fan, but I hope to that. But on an even more optimistic note, I'm hoping that the pandemic that we've lived through will have more lasting positive changes in how we understand our need for connection, the importance of balancing home and work life, have and keep the conversations about our humanity more possible in the workspace. I think the pandemic has opened the door to more of that. So I'm hopeful that that will be sustained. I think maybe break this old notion that is still sometimes prevalent that that when we go to work, we leave ourselves, you know, part of ourselves at home. So how for this to change?
Well, and I think the interesting thing about this last year is that we haven't left the home. And so that break, as it were, I was discussing this with somebody and we were calling it this transitional other. And just you know, we kind of need the separation, but also it can become an unhealthy separation. The drive for myself in this work is to help organizations become more human, more hopeful, and more helpful. And I think it resonates for me that whilst our humanity has kind of been brought right to the fore in this last, you know, more than a year, so important that we keep it at the fore in a less frenzied, less crisis, less, you know, fragile way, but in a way that we can cultivate to nourish oneself and each other.
Lovely.
So what can we do to be more helpful in our own teams.
Mm. Found that really helpful in our own teams, because interestingly, I've just joined a new group myself, you know, it's a long established one. It was interesting to have the experience again of being the newcomer and to get to, you know, to learn the culture of the group I was joining, and that innate sort of pull to adapt, to belong, you know. And that really made me think about how we can all challenge ourselves more on this continuing about adapting and differentiating. So how can we be more helpful is maybe by, you know, going back, making best use of ourselves to share in service of the team we're in, what we sense more, what we feel, what we notice. Just be braver, really. There's this Gestalt writer that talks about how can we turn up our perceived weirdness index. You know, so how to be more weird enough in the sense of bringing difference, bringing novelty, bringing provocation, bringing new thinking and ways of being. But of course, not too weird to be spat out either. So, you know, I had to keep that, you know, be helpful in that way.
And I've always reflected in recognizing that when we're new to a team or an organization, that uniqueness shows up most. But of course, we normalize to their norms and to the, you know, over time. So again, it's I always think it's a gift if you have a new team member, because you get to see through their eyes for a while, and they will lose that gift over time. And so, you know, I think sometimes we concentrate on what we can share with them, not so much what do we learn from them.
So true.
So, I'm sort of curious with our sort of fellow practitioner community, and what galvanizes or inspires you. And I wanted to invite you, if there's something special for you to share with our listeners, whether it by way of poem or book or quote.
Yes, you sent me that question, and I felt immediately a response. I think that was the first question. I thought, oh, isn't that fascinating? That's great. And I love poetry. And so it gave me the excuse of going back to my poetry, which was lovely. Wonderful. And I decided that perhaps to share with you a poem by Mary Oliver that maybe some of you might know, called Wild Geese. And for me, the poem is a call to be more authentic, not to worry about being good or doing the right thing, but more about finding your place in the world, you know, your place, you know, as a leader of teams or as a coach, and trusting your process in the moment. And then after I chose it, it's occurred to me how much the behavior of geese are actually used in teamwork, you know, in the old view of, you know, a team, how they fly in the V formation, how they take turns to lead, how they support each other. So it just felt very appropriate.
Thank you. Well, we'll put all the references that you've made up onto the website, and a link to the poem as well. So thank you so much, Marianne. I hope you find that interesting. I'm always keen to understand the different orientations people bring to working with teams and organisational development. And that question that Marianne posed early on, how do we believe change actually happens in organisations? And there were certainly many aspects of what Marianne described as a Gestalt approach that shows up in other ways of practising, including using the self and presence. We heard Michael Jaskalson in the episode about mindfulness talking about the importance of presence and awareness. And it showed up in Leslie Roberts also, as she explored what working with teams in nature. So it's interesting to see how some of the concepts and ideas coalesce, but also important, I think, to understand what your theoretical underpinning is when you're working with change. So how did you get on with your questions?
how do you think change actually happens in your team or organisation? And what is the joint question most important for your team to come together on? And then, as Marianne talked about the perceived weirdness index earlier in the episode, how do you bring or encourage in others their perceived weirdness to bring new thinking and new provocation to your team or organisation? I hope you enjoyed the episode. Details of how to get in touch with Marianne and any references from this episode are on my website, which you'll find under www.debbiewaith.com. I'll be releasing a new Team Time Table Talks every Tuesday. We'd love for these to be accessed by all those who you think would be interested by sharing on your favourite platform. And remember to subscribe to not miss the latest episode. Thanks for listening, and I wish you a hopeful and helpful week ahead. Goodbye.
Subscribe to Team Time.